This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp, and Zach is off once again filming the Green Berets for the next 2 weeks, and I am very happy to have a well-known Trek FM alumni aboard. He is the co-host of Earl Grey, self-proclaimed star of Earl Grey, Trek FM's production manager, and an associate producer for Standard Orbit, and good friend Richard Marquez. Richard, welcome to the show.
Oh, hey, thanks for that great intro.
Yeah, you don't think the other guys are going to be too mad that you said that I had, you know, it's in your contract that you were the star of Earl Grey. That's okay, right?
No, that's okay. That's okay. I'll bill you later.
Okay. It's what's in your rider. I hope you have the champagne and green M&Ms and all the other things you asked for. You good?
No. It's purple M&Ms, dude. And I need rose petals all over my couch in my dressing room. That's a Bieber joke, sorry.
You are a very high-maintenance guest, let me tell you. I went on your show just for the honor of appearing, but, you know, I understand. You had to reduce yourself to come to Standard Orbit. I get it, no worries. But in all seriousness, Richard, I'm glad you're here today. We've been doing a lot of, I think, interesting topics, and we keep trying to come up with new and different ideas. And in this week's show, I think we're really going to put our geek on and have some fun, and we're going to be talking some battles. But before we do, I have a quick message I wanted to read from our buddy Brad Alexander. He emails a lot. He's been a longtime listener. He's not on Facebook, and I'm behind. There's a couple of other messages I have to catch up on that I will. One that was pretty critical of us, and I want to make sure we put the good with the bad. I just don't happen to have my hands on it right now, but I will do that. So Brad writes, another great show idea, guys, though I have to admit Trek and pop culture is a huge subject area. Boy, he's right about that. I was mowing my grass yesterday while I was listening, and it was yelling in glee every time you mentioned a reference, especially when you started out with Saturday Night Live skit, back when SNL was funny. The Carol Burnett one, the In Living Color one. Oh, forgive the non sequitur here, but I have another podcast you should be listening to. Mike Rowe of Dirty Jobs and Deadliest Catch fame does a podcast for curious people with short attention spans. Not sure how to take that, Brad, but I do like Mike Rowe. Called The Way I Heard It. Ken, you would probably remember Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story from our childhood. I used to listen to Paul Harvey on WBZ 10:30 a.m. in Boston every single day. So yes, I do remember, Brad. Well, this is Mike Rowe's homage to that show. A couple of them, I think, are appropriate, and he sent me some links. As for some pop cultural references, I am with you, Senior Chief, about Friends and to the extent of Seinfeld. I've referred to them as shows with kind of whiny New Yorkers and first world problems. Funny someone else was saying that earlier. I can take or leave the Big Bang Theory, and not only am I a Star Trek geek, but also a Linux geek, and many of their jokes are just entirely too on the nose. Stargate also has a rich Star Trek referencing pool. And if you count fan films, Corin Nemec, who played Jonas Quinn on SG-1, also played Captain Alvarez in Star Trek Renegades. Oh, I remember that. Okay. Finally, one of the most important pop culture effects of Star Trek is the fact that Ronald Moore's reimagined Battlestar Galactica was actually born in the Deep Space Nine writer's room. I didn't realize that's where he came up with it. Apparently, Ronald Moore said there were stories that he wanted to tell that couldn't be told in the Star Trek universe. Well, that definitely makes sense. For me personally, DS9 is my favorite Trek, even though Kirk is my captain, as he should be. In fact, the BSG, DS9, and the Honor Harrington series are some of my favorite pieces of science fiction. Have either of you read the Honorverse books? Have you read any of that, Richard?
Nope, can't say that I have. No. Mm-mm.
I'll have to look that up, yeah. It might be an interesting to-do side-by-side comparison of the Harrington universe to the Star Trek universe. I've got to do that. Anyway, what do you think? Well, first, Brad, I always appreciate your feedback. I appreciate all our listeners' feedback, and it's fun to be able to engage. And I do like the fact that you send in nice emails, well thought out, constructive, and you know, your opinion matters a lot. You know, us old people, we got to stick together. So, I everything you wrote, I pretty much agree with, and I do think very highly of who was the name of that guy who did. Mike Rowe, who did The Dirty Jobs and Deadliest Catch. I know he's the narrator for Deadly. Mike Rowe did a segment up in Lake Winnipesaukee not that long ago on Dirty Jobs, and I have a house up there, and I got a real kick out of it. So, yes, thank you. Thank you for writing, and we appreciate the feedback. And if anyone wants to send us a note at any time, we'll be happy to read it. I said good or bad, and it was a real bad one, Richard, I got from a guy named Wright was his last name, and Wright didn't write nice things, but that won't keep me from reading it. I just got to pull it back up and get it out of a folder. So anyway, yeah, he did not like our review of Star Trek 09 at all, and he had Phaser set for disrupt. Let's put it that way.
Ooh, so, that's rough.
Yeah, it was a little rough, but that's okay. You know, some people are passionate about Trek, and we know that. I think our goal on this show is as much as possible is to find that that neutral fun area, especially where we're digging into stuff that's really old, except for our new movies, and trying to keep it as entertaining as possible, thought-provoking when we can, and we move on. So today, Richard is here to talk about a subject that I have a lot of interest in. Now, it's always dangerous when Zach goes on trips. He's filming the Green Berets somewhere up in Alaska. I don't think it's going to come off too well if it's a jungle story, but I didn't tell him that. We're going to be focused today on which of the battles was a better battle. So we're calling it the Battle of the Battles. I don't know if that title will stick for the podcast, but I like the Battle of the Battles. And Richard and I were talking earlier in the week, and we decided to compare the Battle of the Mutara Nebula from The Wrath of Khan to the Battle of Khitomer. I would say Camp Khitomer, I guess, would be appropriate. Mm-hmm. And there were two battles of Khitomer. There was one in TNG fame from yesterday's Enterprise. But there was one that was made... there was a battle that occurred before that during the initial peace talks from the Undiscovered Country. So we thought we'd take a look at those two sequences and find out which one was more kind of entertaining, relevant, and the strategies that were involved. So Richard, if you wouldn't mind, if you feel comfortable, and if you have your Wayback Machine there, because I got to get you out of this. I'm just going to shake that D off you a little bit there and get you back into the standard orbit area, back into the to the A, or I should say the refit.
Squeeze in, because there ain't no room in this ship.
That's right. So can you kind of set up the stage a little bit, maybe starting from the time that the... That Kirk got back on the Enterprise from regular one.
It's basically you're fighting without, in a sense, without a view screen. It's a little different, but it's kind of the same. And you're fighting basically with your sensors and trying to guess where the other person's going to be and sort of thing. But, you know, like Spock says, he's a two-dimensional combat leader or whatever you want. He thinks two-dimensionally. Why don't we think three-dimensionally? Which makes sense because, I mean, you got the Z-axis as well going up and down. So, of course, Kirk wins the battle thanks to Spock. And, yeah, he saves the day in a sense before the Reliant is hits the self-destruct button on the Genesis device.
Well, he activates the Genefish torpedo,
right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. Which, in a sense, destroys the Reliant. But...
Right.
Fantastic battle.
It was a fantastic battle. It, you know, coming off Star Trek The Motion Picture, where there was, you know, other than some Klingons firing some torpedoes and blowing up an asteroid, there wasn't a lot of that. And I think, you know, they brought back that action and adventure element to Star Trek II. So briefly from the Undiscovered Country, we had a battle of a different sort. Also, I would say, you know, more or less just like Balance of Terror, because you have a cloaked ship involved. And, you know, somehow or another, the Klingon Empire built a prototype Bird of Prey that allowed to fire when cloaked. And that put, obviously, the Enterprise at a serious disadvantage. And so, really, the battle was a much smaller ship in the Bird of Prey, but it had a tactical advantage on the bigger, much more higher profile target of the Enterprise. And really, it was almost much more of a pummeling than a battle, because every time they tried to get a fix on when the Bird of Prey shot, it would instantly move into another position before, you know, phasers could lock on or whatnot. And I guess they couldn't lock on because the dang thing was cloaked. So it became kind of this this cat and mouse, and then the USS Excelsior showed up to take some of the firepower and take some of the hits. And while it was taking a little bit of a pummeling, the Enterprise was able to reprogram a torpedo that allowed it to find the exhaust of the Bird of Prey, and that's how it won. So I say that, you know, kind of to give you kind of a brief synopsis of that, but it was really just kind of a survival game for the Enterprise until it could figure out the trick in order to take out the Bird of Prey. And you go back to the Mataara Nebula battle, and it was really a battle of wits between a superhuman genetically engineered guy who had a lot of intelligence, was blinded a little bit by vengeance, I should say a lot of it, and a Starfleet veteran who had been rusty. He hadn't been in the captain's chair in many years, and was taking on, I guess, this supervillain. And so one of the aspects, let's start with the Battle of the Mataara Nebula, Richard. One of the things that I thought was really interesting that Nicholas Meyer, Jack Sowards, the rest of the team kind of came up with was, here you had a crippled Enterprise, right? There was an earlier battle where the Reliant took out engineering, took out a lot of its warp drive. Its main power was down for quite a bit. So it was sputtering on impulse. It had one torpedo launcher that could fire effectively. I think it had most of its phaser banks. But what they did was they set it up so that the Enterprise was much more heavily damaged. And the way to mitigate the Reliant's advantage of sensors, view screens, or whatever, was to hide in this nebula. And it also kind of created a pretty cool background. What did you think of that whole concept?
I really liked it. I mean, it kind of reminded, I mean, one of my favorite submarine movies is actually Crimson Tide. And I love the whole hiding in all that with the subs and everything and trying to find each other. And, you know, it, obviously, as they're talking about trying to find each other, they're explaining what's going on and how they do what they do. And that's kind of like what this movie does as well. I mean, in a sci-fi, you know, space battle kind of thing. I mean, everything's not the same, obviously, like sonar doesn't exist in space. But like, I really enjoyed it. It's by far one of my favorite space battles that are out there. I mean, besides Nemesis, that's actually my favorite. But like, it's definitely one of those episodes that you know, obviously it just shows how witty and how brilliant of a tactician. I mean, let's say that he never left the captain's chair. I could only imagine what he would do. And it's just, I mean, he's not stupid, or he's not a stupid commander, or he's not one of those reckless commanders that goes guns a-blazing, as we saw in the Balance of Terror. Because he was very careful in that episode as well. And I could only imagine what he would be like. I think he would be a lot more sharper. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, as they say, all skills are perishable. And, you know, you can develop a kind of atrophy when you don't you know, flex a muscle or, you know, use your brain to think in those terms. So if you're an admiral and you're basically administrative, or even if you're strategic and you're thinking about operations, that's more long-term thinking. It's more deployment thinking. It's not tactical. And that's what's really cool about, I thought, the whole premise of the battle. Because if you step it up back a bit, first they fooled Khan with a relatively simple, you know, by-the-book phrase by using open communications to make it seem like the Enterprise was in worse shape than it was. Mm-hmm. They had a predetermined destination where they literally were just hiding on the other side of the planet and then, you know, gunned it into the Mataara Nebula, knowing that the Reliant would see them, but hoping that they could get in there before they caught up. And I thought all of that was pretty brilliant and well thought out. And that comes a lot from familiarity. So when you're in units that work closely together, that's a lot of what their training involves. It involves understanding how your commanding officer thinks, or how your operations officer thinks, how the folks in positions of responsibility respond to things, and that's why it becomes second nature. And in this battle, I think that's really demonstrated very strongly that. You know, I forget the episode in TNG where they just make a couple of glances and nods, and the next thing they know, they capture an alien with a force field. Never had to say a word. It's very similar to that in terms of instinct. This is what we're going to do, and they played it beautifully. And Khan, who was just for all his intelligence, you know, really lacked the strategic thinking element because he was so blinded by vengeance. Realized that he was giving up a tactical advantage. You know, when you're on a starship and you've got unlimited power and time and your oxygen isn't going to run out, you find a nice position to wait. You know, it's just like you made up a good point with Crimson Tide. You know, submarines will hide below thermal layers and things along those lines. And yeah, it could be quite a while to wait. Would make one hell of a boring movie, but that would actually be the smarter approach. If your ultimate goal is just to kill the son of a gun, then, and you know, you've got nothing but time, then take it. So I think the battle of the Mataara Nebula was really well scripted. It was entertaining. I thought the effects of the nebula, which we saw again in TNG and some other episodes, was incredible in its design. I give a lot of credit to ILM for, I believe it was just like mixtures of chemicals and water, and it created these neat colors. And, you know, it had electrical discharges. You know, even for 1982, those special effects still, they still show up pretty well today, I think. Richard, what do you think?
Yeah, I actually do. I mean, even with the updated graphics, is that the right word? No, it's not really. Yeah, graphics. Forget it. I mean, even with the updated graphics that when they touched it up, I mean, it still looks amazing. I mean, it, especially with, I mean, ILM does some really good work. They really do. I mean, you can't, I mean, I've read so many documentaries about how they make spaceship battles, and just it something as simple as like the Enterprise, the camera's going right by the Enterprise, and it takes like what, 3 hours or something like that to get it right, completely right. But I mean, it's so awesome on how they do that, and how, and the amount of detail that they have to put into that work. It's just. I mean, I can only imagine how long it took. I mean, maybe it took 3 weeks to do that, a whole entire scene or something like that. But I mean, it was just absolutely amazing. I can't give them any more credit than what I've already given them, because it's definitely, I mean, by far, The Wrath of Khan is one of the best movies in the Star Trek universe overall, or at least in my opinion, it is. But like it's beautiful. It really is. It's absolutely beautiful. Yeah.
No, I agree. I mean, Wrath of Khan is a great movie, and you know, did a lot to, I guess, revitalize the franchise even more. And one of the things that's interesting about this battle, and we'll switch it to the Undiscovered Country and the Battle of Camp Khitomer in a minute, was, you know, I heard you at the beginning saying, well, you know, the Reliant being a Miranda class may not have been as powerful as the Enterprise. To me, the Reliant seemed to be more powerful. It had that that roll bar with the torpedo launcher, both forward and aft. It had as many phasers, I think, as the Enterprise, maybe down a few. And it was, you know, much more compact, less vulnerable, right? The as we saw in Beyond, the neck of the Enterprise was very vulnerable. And they did do some damage across that torpedo bay against the Enterprise, whereas, you know, the Reliant just didn't have a profile. It was kind of a flying brick. So, you probably had some clearer things that you could shoot at, but less vulnerable. I mean, you know, it hit the nacelle, which was vulnerable, and it blew off an engine. It was the first time we saw that in Star Trek history, and that was pretty cool. But overall, I felt like the Enterprise might have been a little bit outclassed in terms of weaponry. The Reliant just looked like a menacing corvette with a lot of firepower. And the Enterprise, you know, very graceful, powerful in its own right, but, you know, much more that that streamlined ship that, you know, could certainly take care of itself in a fight, but was made more for exploration. And that's kind of how I looked at the two ships.
That's true. I mean, it very well, I mean, tactically, I mean, obviously it outclassed it no matter what. I mean, obviously that was, he should have been put up shields anyway, regardless, based on that regulation. But like, I mean, definitely, I mean, I guess you could compare, I mean, if we were to modernize it more, I guess you could compare that to the Nebula class starship, which actually basically was a battleship, and you know, it basically, you know, it was like a destroyer. Destroyer, battleship, one of the two. It definitely had a lot of guns on it, and it had a lower profile too. So, I mean, I guess it's kind of harder to hit. I would assume so, but I would assume that, I mean, because I know the Constitution class was it the retro, wasn't it? That was in Ravicon. Yeah, it was the refit. So maybe So maybe the Reliant was the newer starship, because I think the Constitution was older. So
it's hard to say, because the you could say that the Enterprise was older because it was refitted, but the only thing that wasn't touched was one tile in the men's bathroom on deck 6. Otherwise, the entire ship was refit from stem to stern, and, you know, it had increased power of its phasers through the engines. It had technically, if you read the schematics on it, it supposedly had a cloaking device in the motion picture if it needed to use one, which I thought was kind of cool, but it obviously never went that way. And you know, so it was modernized. Where I get a little confused, and this is where, you know, I think Mr. Atos, Jeff, was always very helpful with, was what the timeline was between the motion picture ending and the pickup of The Wrath of Khan. And we get the sense that it's been a good 5 years or more, or beyond that. So from the time it was refit, it had aged a bit. Not terribly, but it went from being a ship of the line, and though it had a training crew and it wasn't a training ship, they were manning the ship for more missions. So it had, mm-hmm. it had somewhat of a lifespan. In the next movie, in Star Trek III, we find, you know, this ship is 20 years old. So do they mean from the time it was refit? Because it was a lot older than that if you go back through Star Trek history. You know, it was 20 years old during the TOS timeline. It was, you know, the ship had been around. So it's just interesting. So I think, you know, if you looked at the bridges and all that other stuff, you would get the sense that the Enterprise was a little bit more modern and more updated. But, you know, old doesn't necessarily mean inferior when it comes to weaponry, firepower, things like that. So, you know, probably if it was a fight where you say the shields were raised at the beginning, it probably would have been much more of a, I wouldn't say a fair fight, because half the battle is just winning it. And Khan was genius in how he fought it and how he took out their shields and knew exactly where to hit them. It would have been interesting to see if the ship's just mano a mano, which one would have been able to slug it out, you know?
I think the Miranda would have definitely lost.
It's the Enterprise, yeah, dude. It's the Enterprise, yeah.
We're the slug it out like heavyweight fighters. Yeah, I think the Enterprise would have won that one.
Of course it would, because, you know, the Enterprise should always win, always, always, always. We should have no suspense in that. The Enterprise rocks.
Okay. It's the flagship of the fleet.
At least it was in the Next Generation. It definitely was the flagship of the Federation. So then let's transit over to the Undiscovered Country, and then we'll kind of pull the whole thing together. So the Undiscovered Country was definitely what Nick Meyer loves. You know, he loves that submarine element of things. Mm. You've got a ship that can cloak, can fire from all these different directions, and it just gave the Enterprise fits. And if you think about it, for the whole length of the battle that took across, the Enterprise, I don't think fires a shot for an extended period of time. I mean, I don't know how many hits that old girl took, but you know, it was in pretty rough shape. And I will tell you, from an entertainment piece of it, Richard, for me, it was really hard to watch. It was just hard to watch that ship take a pummeling. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, it wasn't. I mean, if we're comparing it to the Wrath of Khan, yeah, it definitely was not one of those battles that I couldn't really watch either. Because I mean, yeah. It really was difficult to see the Enterprise taking a serious beating again, because I did not want to see it to be destroyed again. Yeah, it really was difficult. I mean, looking at that, it's like you would think that they would have more than one prototype, especially when the Klingon Empire didn't like the Federation at that time. I mean, but then again, they were basically fighting for survival, so for their home planet.
Well, that's the definition of a prototype, right? I mean, and obviously, if you put it through kind of the lens of Star Trek canon, there must have been something wrong with that prototype. So either, you know,
they didn't build a second one in battle. They didn't build a second one, and they didn't keep the schematics.
Well, it could have been, but you know, the way I always look at things like that, when you do have a prototype, usually it's the first type of any new class of ship usually has a ton of bugs in it, and there's issues. And while it wasn't very defined, obviously the ship seemed to function just well. But who knows? You know, we could take this really into geekdom, you know, into the folks that are like trying to make it as real as possible, and that's fine to do. I guess when I was watching it years ago, the way I kind of reconciled it in my head was that maybe it had serious radiation problems, or, you know, you could only launch so many torpedoes, although they launched a ton of them, before the system just gives out and, you know, there's a power surge and the thing is just dead in the water and completely vulnerable. I don't know what it is, but I'm assuming that, you know, it probably after an extended period of use, we would have figured out that flaw, because again, turns out that the ship is more effective when it shoots and it has to use all its power and become uncloaked. So that's just my thought process. There's nothing to back that up. It's just where I went with it.
Right. No, that makes sense. You know, I mean, definitely, I'm sure the radiation problem, maybe that's the reason why they have an exhaust port, which you would think that they would store that on board. because that's the great way to like basically, find out where exactly you're at when you have, when it emits its waste. So,
I guess I took it because they said plasma, right?
Exhaust was?
So I took it to mean that when they're on impulse power, it burns gas, I guess the impulse power units on the Enterprise would burn gas too. It just that's how I took it, and because that there's an emission, in space, I don't know how fast that dissolves or if it just sits there or whatever. I mean, that's always a good question. If it just you know,
well, not long enough for the torpedo to take a maze through space to follow that thing.
Well, yeah, I think the biggest flaw in all of that was that there were a couple. One of the things I've always struggled with Star Trek was you have on the Enterprise 432 people, and I think on the Enterprise refit it's somewhere around 500. So you have 500 people aboard this ship, and I am sure that you would have people that would be weapons experts, like a Carol Marcus, maybe on board. So that if you needed to reprogram a torpedo, which you would think you would just do from a computer panel, not actually open up the guts of it, and install a sensor to go track, you know, gaseous anomalies. None of that made sense to me. And although it was kind of a, for lack of a better term, a cute scene with Spock and McCoy performing surgery on a torpedo, it made no sense that those were the two guys that were doing it and not, you know, a well-trained crewman who's in charge of armaments putting the switching in. That would be a technician's job. And, you know, I get it. I get the screen time. I get all that stuff. But for me, you know, one of the things that will pull me out of a story a lot is if you see all these people on a ship, and we see it all the time in Star Trek, but there's only seven guys that do anything. Now, in any... In any walk of life, I don't care what you do for a living. If you take your 100% of your employee population, 20% of them do 80% of the work, right? You get 20 rock stars. For the most part, everybody else plays Guitar Hero. That's the way it is. But we are so far below that 20, 80% when it comes to the officers of the Enterprise in, or any starship in any incarnation, because that's just the way it goes. And, you know, you would have a Miles O'Brien, a chief, who would be doing that kind of stuff. And so that kind of took me out of it a little bit. And I didn't find it to be that clever because I figure that technology exists today. You know, we have missiles, rockets, torpedoes that can track signals of almost any kind, even exhaust. You know, that's what a heat-seeking missile does. It finds the heat source and goes after it. Or you have the HARM missile, anti-radiation missile. It picks up a transmission and goes right for it. You know, and when it comes to submarines, it's sonar. And once a surface ship's torpedo pings it, the torpedo's going to hit it. So the technology was there. And, you know, to me, it was like, it was mildly entertaining. And I liked the Shakespearean quotes that were coming over and the frustrations that they were having. You know, God, I'd give real money to shut him up and things like that. I thought it was pretty funny. And the quotes that General Chang was quote, I thought were very relevant, you know, and he was into it, cry havoc and all that stuff. So I think the battle itself was somewhat entertaining in that light and funny. But yeah, watching the Enterprise just take hit after hit after hit, and then a real simple solution that the communications officer came up with. Thank God, you know, because I was like, you know, because that's weapons technology for you. But I mean, I understand that it was Spock who started the conversation. So, right. You know, and once again, they saved the galaxy, which was kind of cool. But yeah, the Battle of Camp Khitomer, I don't think comes anywhere close to the Battle of the Mutara Nebula as far as skill set, tactical, any of it. It was much well thought out and much more dramatic, I think, in The Wrath of Khan. What say you, Richard?
I completely agree. I mean, maybe in Undiscovered Country, it would have like the Excelsior come in and, I don't know, start shooting all over the place trying to find them and one or doing something. I mean, come on, Sulu. I mean, you're alumni of the Enterprise. Come on.
All right, so
go ahead.
Yeah, I'm gonna start with something controversial. So the movies were loaded with drama, right?
Right.
They were just loaded with drama, especially, you know, 2 and 3, heavy drama. Five didn't really happen. And then during the Undiscovered Country, what if the Bird of Prey was successful in taking out the Excelsior? Would that have made it more interesting? What if we
probably
lost Mr. Sulu? What if he gave his life to save the Enterprise?
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, if we were to recreate this scene, and let's just say Sulu dies at the end with going down with the Excelsior, and of course the Enterprise saving the day, I would love to see, like, maybe let's say they don't figure out the whole cloaking device thing, and let's say for some reason they disrupt his cloaking device or something like that. I would love to see like torpedoes going through the air and phaser fire and, you know, just seeing a bird of prey actually move in a way that it's supposed to move. Like it's a very maneuverable starship, and it's designed that way. I mean, obviously we've seen that in Deep Space Nine. Some of the bird of prey that are in there. I think this one was bigger than those. I'm not entirely sure. This prototype was bigger than the ones that we saw in Deep Space Nine, which they're the older ones as well. They're the older bird of prey that we've seen in TOS and all that kind of stuff. But like, if it was maneuverable like that, and we saw it cut through the scenes like that, I think it would be a better scene. I wouldn't doubt it if it's because of budgetary they couldn't do that.
Well, I understand the budget.
I'm sure
ILM. They didn't have much money for this movie. It actually
would have been good in CGI. I would have paid to see that. But I mean, if it would have been like that and they were shooting at each other, and let's just say the freaking Excelsior couldn't hit the bird of prey because it was moving too fast or maneuvering too fast or it was cutting and whatnot, then I guess that would probably make it a lot more interesting. What an image went through my head, because since the Excelsior has such a strong neck. And it's got a big underbody. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of like a 20 cannon like ship. And all like I watched Pirates of the Caribbean earlier today, so all I could see was, you know, phaser fire and torpedoes going left to right like it's a old ancient sea pirates or something like that. You know, but that would be cool. I actually wouldn't mind something like that. Just something to make it look pretty cool. Yeah.
I agree with you. I think that it was kind of a lost opportunity. Don't get me wrong, folks. I didn't want to not necessarily see Captain Sulu die, but.
No, not at all.
Every actor, so they say, you know, wants to have a good death scene. And, you know, the Mr. Spock got his, Captain Kirk got a terrible one. But, you know, the way I looked at it is, you know, you probably could not blow up the Excelsior. But let's say a series of torpedoes were heading towards the Enterprise, which at this point was just about crippled. And, you know, it hit, you know, the Excelsior just jumps into the path of those torpedoes, maybe shoots one or two of them down, and the other ones hit the bridge, and you know, the ship goes dark and is just floating there. And then they figure out how to destroy the during that time that it gave the Enterprise, it gave them that opportunity to destroy the bird of prey. I think it would have been, You know, I think of the beginning of Star Trek 09, you know, with that beautiful music amongst all the chaos, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. It could have been a very touching way for Sulu to come in and save the day and give him, you know, his most special moment in what would have been even if you take flashback out of Voyager, that all occurred before this last scene. So he still could have come back for that scene in Voyager. And it wouldn't have impacted it. And it would have been a very dramatic, I think, very emotional moment, because everybody loves Sulu, right? Everybody mm-hmm. loves him. And I think it would have added something to that, because you lost Spock at the end of the Battle of the Mutara Nebula, and it tore our guts out. It wouldn't have been as impactful for Sulu, but it would have been something very memorable. To me, that battle was very forgettable.
Yeah, I totally agree. And she's a tough little ship. That's for sure. Yeah. To take that kind of beating? Yeah. Yeah. And they didn't shoot their disruptors, did they? No, I don't think they did. Yeah, it was all torpedoes.
It was all torpedoes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's the way they played it, and which I guess makes sense. I don't know. I don't think the disruptors are kind of like the jab, 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 and then the right hook is the torpedo. And if the jabs are usually meant to disorient you. So if those torpedoes are coming from any which direction, it really doesn't matter much.
Did you, okay, so since we're talking about Sulu, do you like him as the supporting role that he had in the TOS, or do you like him as captain, or is there no difference between the two?
You know, it's funny. I met George Takei in 1982 at a convention, and a lot of us then who read Starlog and were kind of up in the know back then, realized that in Star Trek II, they had cut away a pretty important scene for George Takei. And he was not happy at all with Star Trek II. I mean, he thought it was a good movie, but he was not happy because he was, in his words, just a bus driver. And the one scene that he had where he was going to be taking over another ship was cut. And you can see that in the shuttle when they're heading to the Enterprise. You know, he starts off saying, any chance to go aboard the Enterprise? And you can see his mouth open to carry on a conversation about his new assignment. And it was all cut out. And then it shows the Enterprise and it cuts back to Captain Kirk saying, I'm just glad to have you at the helm for 2 weeks because I don't think these kids can steer. So there was a lost line in that about him not being assigned to the Enterprise, but essentially going there to help out with the training crews. And he lost that opportunity. And then, of course, in Star Trek III, they didn't give him the Excelsior. It was James B. Sinking that had the role. They gave him a nice little piece. Star Trek IV, the poor guy, supposed to have a scene with his great-great-great-grandfather, a little kid, and they can't get the kid to behave, so they had to cut that out of the movie. You know, Star Trek V, relegated to just being, you know, an automaton that gets corrupted by Cybok. So in Star Trek VI, he finally had a role of note. The guy paid his dues. He was he didn't whine about it too much. Like I said, he was upset that he was just a bus driver, and they had to actually go to see him at his house because he wasn't going to do Star Trek II to convince him to be in the movie because it just wouldn't be Star Trek. And then they cut out the most important scene that he wanted. But he stuck with it. So I guess I can't divorce myself from, you know, do I like Sulu better as the helmsman, you know, warp factor, whatever, and whatnot. Because, you know, as the helmsman, sometimes, like in Star Trek the Motion Picture, he took the con, he had a few more lines. You know, he was utilized. But in Star Trek VI, that was his big break. And I thought he played it well. I thought he played a very good captain. You know, I think highly of George Takei and what he's been through and his experiences. I've had some issues kind of more recently with some of the things he's been saying with the kind of the William Shatner thing. It's like, come on, dude, you're both in your 80s. Let's hug and make up. But let's, you know, if you just focus on it for me, I loved him in that role. And I think it would have been a glorious ending if he had saved literally saved the Enterprise and gave up his own life. And there would have been, you know, a different level of reverence for him and his character if they were able to pull that off.
Yeah, I didn't realize there were that many opportunities that were missed for him. And the reason why I was asking that, because as we were talking about the Excelsior and him coming in to the battle at Kenimer, I was just thinking that, you know, to me, I thought he did better on Voyager than he did on the Undiscovered Country. And I thought he overplayed it, or at least that's how I saw it. It wasn't as relaxed, but that's just me. I mean, because mm-hmm. I mean, I remember Sulu from all the episodes and everything. And anytime he came up, it didn't even matter if it was the main role or whatever. Well, he never had a main role, but like anytime he came up, it was exciting to see him act, and it was great. And I actually liked him in as a supporting actor in all the other movies as well. I just thought he went a little bit overboard. Didn't go overboard in Voyager. He was perfect in Voyager. That's one of my favorite episodes of Voyager.
Is it?
And, oh yeah. Oh yeah. I love. Oh, well, I mean, it was a guest. I mean, it was George Takei. I mean, come on. You know, the lost missions of the Excelsior sort of thing. But like, yeah, I thought he was perfect in that, but it's just, I don't know. I thought it was just a little bit overboard, but then again, it's not like they got any action anyway, so it didn't really matter. So,
well, I thought he had some of the better lines in the movie, which, you know, it's just kind of funny, you know, like, fly her apart then, or, you know, just that calm, just looking at there and just, you know, when the first hit on the bird of prey, and he's like, target that explosion and fire, just this very calm demeanor. And you know, let's just take him out. So I thought he had some pretty good lines, and, you know, the departure, you know, with the whole crew on the screen, on the screen was cool. It was nice, you know, take care.
No, that was not cool. Genuine. Nice. That was perfect.
It was perfect. And, perfect. Yeah, they did a nice job with both casts, just kind of, you know, filling up the view screen. So, yeah, it was with Rand and everything. But I guess, like I said, I was very happy for George Takei. For whatever reason, I was always a bigger Chekhov fan. I don't know what the reason is. I just did. I always thought he was kind of a cool dude, and maybe it was the Russian or whatnot. And Chekhov had so many more opportunities when it came to the Star Trek movies. He just did. He had a big role in Star Trek 2, a pretty big role in Star Trek 4, a decent role in Star Trek 5. You know, he took the Khan again. And then, you know, in Star Trek 6, he was kind of the guy that was relegated, but he had more shots than Takei. And then Nichelle Nichols, that poor lady, you know, she is such a trooper and such a team player. They never really gave her a lot to do, you know, and then what they did give her to do in Star Trek 5 was a little. So anyway, we just had one of our famous Standard Orbit tangents, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Sorry, that was
because that's what we do. Yes, but you know, it's good conversation, Richard. It really is, because you know, we root for our heroes. We cheer for all the cast. We love them, even though there's the big three in the original series. We cheer for all seven. We love them all. And you know, they never really got the because they weren't on the air long enough to get the attention that so many of the folks did on the Next Generation. And you know, some of that exposure on TNG was overexposure, you know, and they would fall into trends. We never got to even get it to that point with the original series crew. But I'll say one exception: Chekhov does tend to scream a lot. I don't know what it is, but he screams a lot.
Well, he wants to be heard. I mean, no one can hear him through that accent.
I don't know. You know, they stick things in his ears, and you know, it's just kind of a rough thing. Or you know, he gets electrocuted during the battle, during the scene in Star Trek: The Motion Picture. You know, he's just like, he's on fire. His ears are on. It's just bad stuff. You know.
That's right. Because the Wrath of Khan, he had that bug in his ear. Yeah, yeah.
It was a little bit more than just a bug, buddy.
slug, bug, you know, slug with armor, whatever.
Yeah. So, final comments, Richard, as you think about the two battles we talked about here.
Definitely comparing the two. The Wrath of Khan takes it by a long shot, obviously. Mm-hmm. Now, if we were to compare it to Next Generation, that might be a different story. I mean, especially against the movie, I will not say. But like, yeah, I mean, overall it's a great movie. It's a great battle scene in The Wrath of Khan. It didn't click in my head like it was like with The Balance of Terror until I watched The Balance of Terror again, and I'm like, oh, we've seen this before. Oh yeah. And it's a really cool scene. I love every minute of it. So, but yeah, love the Undiscovered Country. It's an important movie to watch too.
Yeah, well, you know, we weren't talking about the movies holistically. I think there's a lot of people. You know, if you were to say which is the better movie, I think it would be a much deeper conversation. And you know, I'm guessing more people kind of sway towards The Wrath of Khan, but I'm not sure. I've heard people say the Undiscovered Country is their favorite. I think Bichet has that as his favorite, as a matter of fact. I know he loves the music in Undiscovered Country, which did have a great score. They both had good scores, very good scores. But yeah, I agree with you, Richard. There really wasn't much of a contest. It seemed like it could be a bigger, broader discussion when you talk about the two. I think we had fun with it, but yeah, soup to nuts, the battle of the Mitara Nebula was much more engaging and much more thought out, I think, and it worked out for both movies. Actually, the circumstances were very different, but both enjoyable. And you know, I'm sorry. Every time I laugh when you bring out like battles in TNG, because the first thing I want to say is, how can you have a battle when you surrender off the bat? But there were a few pretty decent battles, but you know, they usually, like even in yesterday's Enterprise, they just seemed to get pummeled, and it seemed to be a thing that even in the movies, the TOS movies, they kind of went in that direction too. I'm not sure why, and it didn't get any better in the reboots. You know, it's like dang, I just want to have the most powerful, badass, kick-ass starship. I want it to be a ship of exploration, but if somebody's going to kick sand in its face, it just completely knocks you backwards. And yeah, it just doesn't seem to happen with these movies. Well, anyway.
She's a tough gal.
She is a tough girl. Yep. She's a beautiful lady and we love her, right? So Battle of the Battles isn't the only thing we are discussing this week on Trek FM. So here's a quick look at what else is playing on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Saturday Morning Trek.
He's like the little kid from the very last episode of Saint Elsewhere. Boba Fett and all this takes place in the head of Chewbacca's son. The whole panoply of Star Wars. It all takes place in Lumpy's head, all of Star Wars.
I think that we may have cracked the code of Star Wars altogether.
I think we did. Lumpy created Boba Fett.
Warp 5.
They never really do say what sport it is, right? We just assume it's baseball because he said doubleheader.
Well, he went to a baseball game with Herd, and he said baseball.
I think he said baseball in Doylestown earlier. So.
Yeah.
Oh, well. All right. Well, sorry, writers. You messed that one up then.
I don't even want to do this commentary anymore. Let's switch it to something else.
Melodic Treks.
Two things to say about that. The first is that Horner was really good at writing sustained cues. Always has been. Going back to some of his early stuff like Star Trek II, where you have the Battle of the Mutara Nebula, you know, that's not necessarily an easy thing to do.
The 602 Club.
And it's not subtle, but this is what happens. Ego is what happens when you only find meaning in yourself and you are truly all that matters.
And introducing our newest show, Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
The key thing with Jetrelli is all of these elements are exactly the same thing as the events in real life. You know, the Metreon Cascade is the bomb. Rhinax is Nagasaki or Hiroshima. You know, the poisoning is analogous to radiation poisoning and all these different things. And the parallels are enormously overt with Jetrelli straight away.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
You can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at Trek.fm and grab the RSS link as well. If you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button. That makes it easier for our listeners to find the show as they search iTunes and help us increase our visibility for new listeners. Speaking of new listeners or ways that you can help our network, Patreon. Patreon.com/TrekFM. This is how you, as fans, listeners, can help support our network. You know, we have over 20 shows on this network, and it's pretty expensive to get the bandwidth and to beam this thing through Libsyn Pro and to get the equipment that we need. It's quite hefty. There's a lot of shows coming out, and we do it all commercial free. We don't interrupt any of our conversations to have commercials, and I think that's a big deal, and we love being able to kind of talk through things. So if you can spare any amount, we would appreciate it. $15. If you can donate $15, you could join the roundtable. Trek FM's way of bringing in a lot of our listeners into podcasting, and that's kind of how I found my way. I was on the very first roundtable a couple of years ago in June, and ever since, it's been quite a ride. And if you donate $25 a month or more, you can be an associate producer on the show of your choice. Now, this is where I get very, very thankful, a little bit emotional, actually. We have the best group of associate producers of any show. I've said it for a long time now. We may not have the highest rated show, but we've got the fiercest, most dedicated listeners. And we've got seven phenomenal associate producers. So I'd like to say thank you to Renee Roberts. Richard, thank you. Aaron Harvey, Nick Anastasio, Tim Robertson, Norman Lau, and Corey Elrod. Zach and I are thrilled to have all of you supporting this show, and we appreciate you very much. So, Richard, where can we find you on the interwebs?
Well, everyone can hear me on Earl Grey. I'm one of the co-hosts with Amy Nelson and Lee Hutchison, where we talk about everything about the TNG universe. You can also find me on the Babel Conference. I pop in here and there, stir a little trouble in the pot. And I am also on Twitter. I don't do that often, but sometimes. Okay. But you can also find me on Twitter. My handle is XRansom.
XRansom. Where'd that come from?
It's an old high school, I guess, self-nickname. It's a combination of a band that I used to love, which was called Ransom. And there was another band that I absolutely love. It was called X-Human. And both of them were metal bands. So I combined the two. And
oh,
there we go.
Okay. Isn't it funny? Because you hear things like that and you start to wonder, well, what could that mean? X-Ransom. Was he kidnapped? I just didn't know. So
That's what everyone tells me when I'm online. When I'm playing PlayStation, I was like, what does that mean? Were you previously held for ransom? I'm like, no.
Were you held for ransom and nobody paid? Aw. Aw.
Well, if no one paid, I wouldn't be here.
Well, maybe they just kind of gave up, you know?
Yeah. Probably.
Yeah, so anyway, you can find me also on the Babel Conference. I'm on there as often as I can be when work allows, but I love interacting with the folks, and hopefully you have a good sense of humor because I like to take some digs and poke some fun at it too. You know, life is so serious. The whole reason we do this is to escape a little bit and have some fun. You can also find me on Twitter. I am at Boston, SCPO. That stands for Boston Senior Chief Petty Officer. And I want to thank Richard one more time for joining me this week. It was fun. We have some of the better conversations. I also want to thank you again for inviting me on to Earl Grey. That was also kind of a pretty cool episode. So I'm glad that everybody on this network is so tight and works so well together.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you, buddy. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.